This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Dr. John Oberlander, and I'll introduce him shortly. I just want to make the comment that things are beginning to put some rubber to the road as we begin to look at how and why and if we should be restructuring some of our healthcare systems in this country. And it's with great fortune that we have Dr. Oberlander available. He has got a PhD in political science from Yale. And he's the Associate Professor of Social Medicine and of Health Policy and Management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's authored a book called The Political Life of Medicare, which explores the development of Medicare politically from its inception till 2003, and as well explores how the political consensus over Medicare unraveled during the 1990s and the reasons for that. He's currently working on a book project on the politics of healthcare reform and a series of articles on cost control and health reform during the Obama administration. I became aware of Dr. Oberlander in an article he wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine right after the first of the year, expressing some issues that were on the agenda, and we're going to be talking about what he foresaw at that time or hoped for, and where we are right now and looking at these efforts at perhaps changing our healthcare system. Dr. Oberlander, welcome to Line One.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I like to start with definitions and basic facts and try to work from that. And I guess the first issue we ought to address is do we need to make changes in our healthcare system and why? It seems to me it wasn't very long ago, within months, that I and only a few of us that I know really thought we ought to do that. And now I heard even the chairman or CEO of General Electric on Charlie Rose saying you'd have to be crazy not to realize we need to change our healthcare system. Why do we need to do that?
Yeah, everyone's on the bandwagon now. We really do have a broken healthcare system in several respects. It's a system that costs too much. We spend about $2.5 trillion on medical care. About one out of every $6 in the economy goes to the healthcare system, and that's much more than any other country in the world. Despite that, we leave tens of millions of Americans without any insurance at all, 47 million Americans were uninsured the last time we had the figures, and when we get the new ones come this fall, we're probably going to be around 50 million, and there are many millions of Americans, in addition, who don't have adequate health insurance and who are underinsured. And finally, American medical care, when it's at its best, is terrific, but too often we're not at its best. It's not at its best, and it's inconsistent quality of care, so we've got a lot of work to do in that area as well.
And that's one of the triumvirate, I guess, that's really pushing all of this is just to reiterate, we got way too much cost compared to everybody else in the world. And despite the fact we think we've got good quality, as you said, that may not be true from lots of ways of looking at it. And at best, it's spotty. And then there's 40 million plus uninsured, which really seems to be the issues we need to be addressing. What is it that's different about how other countries in the world are doing this? And I guess we should draw from conclusion they do it for less cost, better, and are almost mostly universally all their citizens are covered. So what are they doing different?
Well, the first thing that's worth saying is that no country is perfectly content with their healthcare system. There are problems everywhere, and particularly the issue of how to control healthcare spending is an issue across the industrialized world, and it's something that places like Britain and France and Canada and Germany all grapple with. What they're doing differently is that their systems are organized on very different principles. They are universal systems where they cover all their citizens and all legal residents of those countries. They have created systems that are much better at controlling costs than the American system is. And the reason that they're much better controlling costs is, first of all, their administrative spending is, much lower than the United States. We waste a tremendous amount of money on paper and on other administrative costs that don't really give patients better medical care at all. So they really reduce those administrative costs. The second thing that they do is they pay lower prices for medical procedures. And there is profit in some of these other country systems, but the amount of profit is not nearly what it is in the United States. And pharmaceutical companies and medical device manufacturers and so forth are going to make less money than they do in these countries. And finally, in the case of some expensive medical technologies, they use them more selectively than we do. So, for instance, most of the other countries that we compare the United States to don't do as much imaging, as many MRIs as Americans do.
We have a caller already. I'd like to go ahead and take his call and see what his interests are. Paul, you're on line one.
Hey, Ted. This is Paul Hochfeld calling from Oregon.
Hi.
And I just wanted to reiterate what the first speaker was talking about, and that he didn't mention yet the fee-for-service reimbursement system that basically motivates physicians to do more and more and more and more, because we get paid more to do more, without any regard for, you know, sometimes even common sense. And that's especially true towards the end of life. I could go on and on. What's getting in the way of reform right now, I know this is shifting topics, is actually not the healthcare system, it's the political process. And the industry is spending a huge amount of money in Washington right now in order to manipulate public process, public policy, so they can continue to make these huge profits that were alluded to earlier.
Okay.
We have a healthcare system that's actually a healthcare non-system that's a lot better at producing profits than health.
Okay. Dr. Oberlander, your thoughts?
Yeah, first on fee-for-service, there's no doubt that the caller is right. Fee-for-service creates a lot of bad incentives for us to provide more care and more expensive specialty care than we ought to. On the other hand, it's important to realize that there are other countries who employ fee-for-service payments to physicians, and they still control spending. So you can control spending with fee-for-service, but you have to do some budgeting, which we don't do. On the issue of the political system, the caller is absolutely right. The political system does stand in the way of reform. And, you know, healthcare spending is somebody's income. And so when I talked about the $2.5 trillion that we spend, that's $2.5 trillion in income for the insurance industry, for hospitals, for doctors, for drug companies, and so forth. And you have a number of groups that are literally invested in maintaining the status quo in the United States. They are invested in that profitable status quo, and it's very hard to shake it up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The fee-for-service system we have is very heavily skewed, I'm sure you'll agree with me, in favor of the specialists. And because the specialists are getting paid multiples of what the primary care physicians are getting paid, because of the fee-for-service distortions, we're losing primary care doctors by the droves. We're down to 30%. And most of these other countries that we're talking about that have more efficient systems that provide better care for less cost have 50% primary care providers or 60% primary care providers. And so we really need to look at how physicians are being paid, and not just for the fee-for-service system, but within that, who's getting paid what for what kind of procedures. We don't get paid hardly anything in our system to keep healthy people healthy or keep people with chronic disease from stumbling into the ranks of the ill, and that's a huge problem.
Yeah, we've got a shortage of primary care doctors in the United States, and we're going to have a shortage regardless of whether we go ahead and expand insurance coverage. And if we do expand insurance coverage, it's all the more important to take care of that. And I teach medical students, and, you know, not many of my medical students are going into primary care. And it's hard to blame them, given the circumstances of a primary care doctor, which are very difficult right now. So we really do need to take this opportunity and reform to do better by primary care doctors, so more of our students are going into it.
When you talk about expanding insurance coverage, I'm concerned that our politicians are acting like the goal is to give people health insurance. And I would argue that the goal is to give people health. The goal is to give people health care. And the problem with even a public plan option, which is, looks like, you know, that's going to be the big compromise, maybe, is that we'll throw a public plan option towards us. The public plan option is just another insurance company. And we'll still have this healthcare system, this healthcare non-system, that's built around all of these independent insurance companies. And when, and there's nobody really asking this important question, which is how are we going to get the most help from our healthcare dollars? Insurance companies can't control cost. All insurance companies can do is raise premiums, which they're pretty good at, 50% in the last 3 years in Oregon. And they can deny claims, which they're really good at. And when they deny a claim, reasonably, we can accuse them of saying they're denying a claim in the name of profits. If we had a single payer, a single entity that was forced to make difficult decisions about what is or isn't cost effective, that we just can't pay for everybody, then when they make decisions about what isn't cost effective and what they're not going to use public money for, they can say it's done in the name of social justice, if nothing else. And we're not going to be able to pay for everything that everybody wants every time they want it. And that's really at the crux of why every health system in the world is struggling right now.
Yeah, you know, there is a strong case, as I think the caller is making, or alluding to, for single-payer health reform that would replace the existing patchwork system that we have with one government plan, a sort of Medicare for all, and there are all kinds of administrative efficiencies and cost advantages to doing that. I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but I will be, and we are, I'm afraid, stuck with the healthcare system that we've got in the sense that we're not going to erase all the health insurers that are in the system right now. And so the question with reform in 2009 is how are we going to cope with that system? How are we going to improve it? Are we going to be able to regulate those private insurers in a meaningful way? Are we going to be able to create a new government plan that can coexist with those private insurers and provide a stable alternative for folks? And I think that is, unfortunately, about as good as it's going to get in 2009.
Paul, let me ask you to just, if you won't, wouldn't mind, give our listeners how to get a hold of your information, your website, so people can see more of what your thoughts are on this subject.
I've got a video that I produced called Health, Money, and Fear, and it's a 48-minute video that talks about why it costs so much. It's with interviews with John Kitzhoffer and Marcia Angel and Steffi Wohlhandler and a few other people that are quite so far to the left. And it's available on my website at www.ourailinghealthcare.com. And if you send me an email, I'll send you a disc. And if you want to send a donation, fine. If not, that's okay, too. You can also just go to the Internet and search for Health, Money, and Fear. You can find it in chapters on YouTube, or if you go to Blip TV, you can find the whole video on Blip TV.
Okay. Thanks very much for calling.
Yeah, my pleasure. I think that we're going to continue to have a healthcare system that costs too much until we get a handle on cost. And I'm just afraid that we're not going to accomplish what we need to accomplish by playing at the edges of the insurance companies being central to this whole system we've got. They've got too much power in the system, and what we're seeing right now is that our congressional leaders are basically being bought off by their campaign finance, their campaign contributions. Politically not feasible when Pelosi says she would vote for single payer, but it's politically not feasible. And when Merkley says that, and when Harkin says that, what politically not feasible means is that if I vote for it, if I try to advocate for it, then the healthcare industry is going to fund my opponent at the next round of elections. That's what politically not feasible means.
Okie doke. Thanks very much.
You bet.
Appreciate it. Dr. Oberlander, let's go back, if we could, for just a second to what you wrote in your article in New England Journal of Medicine in January 2009, kind of discussing the expectations regarding healthcare reform, and then maybe talking about where we are now, why these expectations have changed, just to try to continue to put some framing on what we're talking about today.
Sure. You know, when I was writing in early 2009, you know, my feeling at the time was this was a long odds proposition, that it certainly was not impossible to have health reform this year during the Obama administration, but that it was improbable and there were, you know, a lot of forces standing against it, including the fact that the administration had to deal with a complex series of other issues, the economy, foreign policy, Iran, North Korea. They have a Congress that, although there are substantial Democratic majorities, they're not extraordinary majorities. It looks more like 1993 and the majorities that Bill Clinton had rather than the huge majorities that, Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson had during the New Deal or the Great Society. And so really an uphill climb. And in my view anyway, health reform has come further and faster than many people, including me, anticipated. And I think in part that's a testament to the successful strategy employed by the Obama administration. And in part that's also a testament to the determination of some key actors in Congress to move health reform forward this year.
Okay. Should we maybe at this point just talk about what are some of the major proposals that at least at this time seem politically feasible, and maybe just outline the structure of those proposals?
Sure. Let me talk about the legislation in the House, because that is where we have the most detail at the moment. The House has three committees that deal with health care, and in an extraordinary move, they have jointly introduced a piece of legislation which is called the Tri-Committee Bill. And so the key features of that legislation, which are accepted by the Obama administration, and indeed they mirror what Barack Obama advocated for when he was running for president in 2008, are as follows. First of all, they would mandate that employers either have to pay for health insurance coverage for their workers, or if they don't, they have to pay a tax to the government, and the government would use that tax to finance health insurance for those workers. Small businesses would be exempted from that requirement. So at the base of this is an employer mandate in the bill on the system of employer-sponsored insurance that currently has about 160 million Americans in it. Then the House bill would create new options for insurance, and they would do this through something called a health insurance exchange. And a health insurance exchange is a regulated market, very much like the connector that is now operating in Massachusetts, a sort of organized shopping mall where you would go and pick from a range of insurance plans. And if you didn't get health insurance through your employer, or if you weren't employed and didn't qualify for Medicaid, you could go to the exchange and you would get subsidies from the government to pay the premiums based on your income. And you could choose from a range of private insurance plans in your area. And those private insurance plans would be heavily regulated. And this is crucial. They could not turn you away if you had a pre-existing condition. They could not, in the House bill, charge you much higher premiums because they thought you were sick, and all sorts of other regulations. In addition to those private plans, you could also choose from a new public health option. And this is where a lot of the controversy is. And the House bill would essentially create a public plan that is something like Medicare, but different from the Medicare program, for people under 65. And that plan would compete with the private plans to enroll folks. So those are really the foundations of what we're talking about here. And if you look at it as a whole, what you see is that the health reform that's under consideration and being pushed in the House and the Senate, it doesn't create a brand new healthcare system as much as it fills in the gaps in the existing system. And it does that by expanding both private and public insurance. And so one of the other things that the House bill would do is expand the Medicaid program.
Okay. Dr. Oberlander, we're going to take just a short break here. I want people to know they're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. We'll be right back.
Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Hi, this is Dr. Thad Woodard again. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. John Oberlander. He's a political scientist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he's written investigated extensively about the considerations for changing in our healthcare system, and that's what we're discussing today. What I hear, we've had a physician call in from Oregon who's expressed desires and beliefs that we're not incenting the right things, which makes some sense to me. But doing it without some radical changes seems to be politically unfeasible. Is that you would agree with that? How about your thoughts on the reasons why it is so politically unfeasible, if you agree with that idea?
Well, I think something like single payer is not feasible. And it's not feasible partly for the reason that the caller raised, which is the insurance industry has a lot of political influence, and a good amount of that influence comes through money into the political system. But that's not the only reason it's not feasible. This is something like single payer that would create a single government program is immensely controversial for ideological reasons. And mm-hmm. So conservatives will raise concerns about the government as Senator from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, the Republican senator, has said, quote, taking over the healthcare system. And they really would regard single payer and do regard single payer as an unwarranted intrusion by the federal government into the healthcare system. And the United States Congress at the moment simply doesn't have enough liberal members to vote something like single payer through. And the final point, which I think is important to understand, is that while Americans are quite dissatisfied with the healthcare system as a whole, many Americans with employer-sponsored insurance like their coverage. Mm-hmm. And so the thinking in Washington, partly as a reaction to what happened 15 years ago when the Clintons tried to reform healthcare, is that you shouldn't try and shake up employer-sponsored insurance too much, because if you do, the folks who like insurance are gonna like their insurance are gonna end up opposing you. And so it's difficult to move to something, be it single payer or something like Senator Wyden has co-sponsored out of Oregon, a sort of universal voucher system, just because they entail making dramatic changes in insurance for people who already have it. And politically, that is a very difficult step to take.
Mm-hmm. And almost it seems like when you talk about politically untenable, again, I'm not a very political person, but I keep thinking it's a lack of understanding, a lack of education in those of us who are voting for members of Congress that really don't appreciate all the differences between how we do things in other countries and the fact that we spend so much more and the fact that our healthcare outcomes aren't as good as we might think they are as compared to other countries, and that almost all of these other countries, particularly in Europe, have no one who's uninsured and no one goes bankrupt because of healthcare costs. Are we just needing to continue to educate better, and that's just going to take some time?
As a educator, I would like to answer yes. The answer is no, Thad. You know, we do need to get more word out there about what other countries do. Many times Americans' conceptions of what happens in Europe or Canada are really based on propaganda, because those systems are used in the political debate, and often the insurance industry and others have an incentive to really paint a caricature of those systems and those caricatures sort of become the basis for our understanding. Having said that, as I mentioned earlier, none of those systems is perfect. And mm-hmm. more importantly, right. even if we could educate everyone perfectly about those systems, this is a country that historically is quite ambivalent about the power of government. So even right. if you educated everyone in the United States about how the Canadian system works and how the German system works, there's still going to be a lot of resistance to moving to a system where the government has a much stronger role.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let's take another caller. Rand, you're on line one.
Appreciate your courtesy. Thank you. I came up here in 75. I retired recently down to Oregon. I'd like to share some impressions, if I may. I'm under a wing of an airplane out here in Wasilla, but share some impressions I've gathered working in healthcare reform the last 2 years down there in Oregon. I don't have an axe to grind. I'm a grandparent, and I want some affordable solutions for my grandkids so they don't have to risk bankruptcy on a constant basis. I do support the single-payer concept, this expanded, improved Medicare for all. And I, with due deference to Dr. Oberlander's perspective on the difficulties politically, let me offer this. I've worked with people presenting single-payer resolutions to small cities and large counties there in Oregon, and those resolutions have been adopted unanimously. And those city councils and those county councils that adopted those resolutions had significant ideological conservatives on them. They had bankers, they had physicians, they had folks that expressed their ideological conservatism. And in all instances, they wanted a full, fair discussion of single payer at the congressional level. The resolutions didn't seek to adopt single payer as the best solution. Those resolutions sought to have a full, fair discussion of the advantages of a single payer solution at the national forum. And those folks, those conservatives on those county councils and city councils, they wanted to hear why the current system had failed for 40 years to deliver, better outcomes in terms of what we pay for. And they all agreed, or all came to a consensus, that we don't get what we pay for. So I was exceedingly impressed how in a relatively short period of time you can present this type of information to intelligent, open-minded people who all recognize the system is broken. Newt Gingrich, I think in page 8 or 10 of his book, says it's broken. The former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle says we're, islands of excellence in a sea of mediocrity in terms of our quality of care. The National Academy of Science said in 2002 that the system was in crisis and incapable of meeting the public needs. When you show people some of the data, they all begin to recognize the current, call it, private insurance-based system has significant questions. Now, I'm not going to minimize the political problems, call it the campaign finance reform issues that we may face nationally and locally. But you can't tell me that good-hearted, intelligent, well-meaning people can't begin to approach this issue in a somewhat rapid way and look at what is best for the public and the public interest. Now, a couple more examples from this. Just recently here, I've had financial benefit consultants come up to us while we're making some of these public events there in Oregon, and they say, for example, and they're advising wealthy clients, they don't even advise insurance purchase any longer as a healthcare tool. They advise it as a risk management tool. In other words, even for wealthy people, the insurance is beginning to be unaffordable. And if you're going to use insurance for a healthcare maintenance tool, you're going to get excluded or you're going to get canceled. So it's a risk management tool from the viewpoint of these financial consultants. At some of these events, I've had chief hospital administrators come up and tell me specifically single payer is where it has to go. And these folks are well aware of, the trends that show we're increasing more administrators and less docs in terms of the relative money. I mean, single payer has been endorsed by the former Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders. It's been endorsed by the U.S. Conference of Mayors. It's been endorsed by 16,000 doctors with the Physicians for the National Health Program. Just the last 60 days in Oregon, we've had two medical associations that have passed some form of single-payer support resolution. Now, I appreciate, and I don't claim any expertise in this area, I appreciate the enthusiasm the public plan concept has in D.C. as potentially, you know, a vehicle for reform. But I called a good economist in D.C. with a large nonprofit operation that focuses on healthcare reform, and I asked him if there are any studies at all to show that the current public plan options would have sufficient economic impact to bring down the future cost curve back down to sustainability. And he said no. And I think that's what the people see on these city councils or county councils when we show them some of the information. They ask the logical question, how do you cut system-wide costs while retaining a fragmented system of 1,000 insurers with 10,000 health plans? How do you cut costs back down to a sustainable level? Now, I think the single payers, the Medicare, the improved Medicare for all people suggests that if we don't have comprehensive form, if we, to use Paul Hochfeld's, Dr. Hochfeld's analogy, if we nibble at the edges, we're not going to have viable, sustainable reform. In other words, it's going to be a failure. But, I mean, that's my point, and I think we really need to look a little more intently at what is feasibility at this point. I support education, and I think we can move a lot faster with education.
Rand, I'm going to ask Dr. Oberlander to make some comments, but I'd like to get you to take the response offline just in effort to be fair to others here. We're getting quite a few phone calls.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. What I hear again is that with a full and fair disclosure at a national level, if that's possible, when people faced with all the facts, they would come around the last two listeners or two speakers to understanding the single payer system. But what I hear you saying, Dr. Oberlander, that still that's a long way. That's for the rubber to meet the road from that standpoint. Do you want to maybe say it a little clearer, or am I misunderstanding your point of view?
Yeah, I think you have it about right, Thad. The great thing about single payer advocates is they've got tremendous enthusiasm, as you're hearing
right.
from these calls, and terrific commitment, and they're very important at the grassroots level. And there is a significant minority in the United States that supports single payer, and their voices, in my view, should be heard more. And I think Congress made a mistake in the health reform debate early on of literally locking single payer advocates out of the process. Having said that, we can talk about all the city councils and all the other important folks who have endorsed single payer, but let me tell you who has not endorsed it. Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, and Harry Reid.
Mm-hmm.
And the political reality, which we may not like, but that doesn't make it any less real, is that the leadership in the White House and in Congress is not going to pursue single payer this year, not going to pursue single payer next year. So it's just not on the agenda at the moment. And it's worth remembering that the first president to introduce a single payer plan was Harry Truman. So we've had about six decades or so of failure at trying to get one, and it's not easy to get any kind of comprehensive health reform, but that should tell us something, and that is that this is a very uphill struggle, and the fact that single payer advocates might be right on a substantive level, and they sure have a lot of good arguments on their side, does not mean that they're going to be able to do this politically, and I'm afraid that's just where we're at.
Okay. Another comment you will hear, and I've actually gotten an email today somewhat reminiscent of this question, is that a lot of individuals in this country, and you've alluded to this already, and also a lot of physicians are concerned about a single-payer system, particularly if it's government-run, because of some difficulties with Medicare. There's physician payment problems that are making it difficult for internists in particular to see Medicare patients. There's been problems with funding. You've written a book about the politics of Medicare. What are your comments on this?
Well, I think one thing we should say is that Medicare has been a tremendously successful program in improving access to medical care, mm-hmm. not just for our nation's seniors, but mm-hmm. also for millions of Americans with disabilities and end-stage renal disease. And it has been an absolutely crucial program in that regard. Medicare beneficiaries are the single most satisfied group in the United States with their health insurance coverage. That's remarkable in the respect that Medicare is a program that, as you suggest, has a lot of holes in it. It is very incomplete coverage. It has high cost sharing and cost sharing that doesn't really make a lot of sense. From a physician's perspective, there's no doubt that there are problems with Medicare, and one of the most pressing problems is the fact that the program underpays, in many circumstances, primary care. And we really need to do something about it. So what I would say is that doesn't mean that Medicare can't be, in some sense, a model. But what we need to do is not take it as a literal model, but think about how we can improve the Medicare program. And there's a lot of work to be done there.
So I always think of things as we've got this perception versus reality. And what I'm hearing you say is we really need to keep a much more open mind about the successes of Medicare and the perception by those who use it that, in general, they're pretty happy, but it's not perfect. And, in fact, nothing is going to be perfect. But we need to keep an open mind about this possibility and its perhaps ability to help us out of our and offer a new way to do health care in this country.
Yeah, we really need that, I think, to emphasize Medicare's successes and not just focus on its shortcomings, which are very real. But if you think about Medicare and the fact that it takes a very expensive, sick population, and it does not do medical underwriting, it will not charge folks higher amounts because they have pre-existing conditions, it will not kick them out of insurance because mm-hmm. they develop expensive medical care, and so on. It has a number of features that, frankly, the rest of the system could use, and so there's much to be learned from it.
There have been other concerns raised about the costs of changing a healthcare system at this time, and you're taking into consideration the extraordinary physical stimulus that's already been provided and our somewhat economic uncertainty, I guess is fair to say. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think people's concerns about the rising budget deficit are understandable and they are legitimate. And we need to talk openly about ways in the future to reduce the deficit. Right now, we're at a point in the economy where we probably need to keep spending more to stimulate it. In terms of the affordability of medical care, my view is that you spend money on things that you deem affordable. We had a projected surplus of, I believe, about $5 trillion back in 1999, 2000, and we could have done health insurance reform then, and we didn't do it, even though we had the surplus, because the uninsured just weren't a political priority. The price tag that we're talking about now is about $150 billion a year. When you consider that we already spend on the healthcare system over $2.5 trillion a year, it's really, I think, a small price to pay, as Uwe Reinhardt has written recently in the New York Times, to make health insurance coverage secure for Americans who, frankly, don't have that security right now. And again, most of the uninsured are working Americans who are in jobs that don't provide them with insurance, and they're uninsured, and often their family is uninsured. And if we can raise the amount that we spend modestly and create a guarantee of health insurance for all Americans, I think that would be money well spent.
It's almost, it seems to me fair to say, it's almost something we can't afford not to address.
Yes. You know, we have to think about the status quo that we have right now, which is a broken healthcare system, or as someone said earlier, a non-system. If we do not do something about health reform, this system is going to continue to unravel, and we won't have 47 or 50 million Americans without health insurance a decade from now. We're going to have 60 or 65 million Americans without health insurance. And many middle-class, well-insured Americans, I'm afraid, are going to lose their coverage if we don't do something about this. So there is a tremendous cost to not acting.
Let's take another caller. Rick, you're on line one.
Hi, Ted. Yeah, I'm Rick Stagenberg. I'm a physician for National Health Care Plan also. And I'd just like to start out by making a couple of corrections to Dr. Oberlander's comments. First of all, it's not a substantial minority, but a majority of people surveyed who support single payer, and that includes 60% of physicians. And the percentage of primary care physicians who favored is even higher. So I think that's important to keep in mind. And also, I didn't read Uwe Reinhardt's article, but the only times I've ever heard him talk, he wasn't talking about health insurance reform, but single-payer system, which is only insurance in the loosest sense of the term. You really can't establish a true healthcare system without, frankly, eliminating the insurance companies as they exist. You can require them to go nonprofit as they did in Germany and use them to be administrators in a competitive fashion. That might actually be the best way to do it and save jobs. But as far as saying that we can't do it because of the political situation, you can't go back and compare it to Truman's time or even to Clinton's time, because we never had the situation before where the industry was going to explode or implode. So we have a unique opportunity here to educate people, and that's what Physicians for a National Healthcare Plan is doing. Right now, people are going to have to listen because the various means that have been proposed for financing the public option, none of them are really politically tenable, which is to our advantage. If it takes 2 years, 3 years, we can still do it, and I believe we will do it, because none of the other options, including the Healthy Americans Act, makes any sense at all. They don't have the cost controls. It's just kicking the ball down the field. It makes no sense. So I think as we educate people, not only about that, but about the fact that politicians, a lot of them already know that and aren't doing anything about it, I think that people are going to vote differently. We already had a substantial turnover in Congress in 2008, and there's another election coming up. So, again, you can't say what's going to happen a year or two from now based on what's happened in the past. That's my comment.
Okay, thanks for your call, Rick.
You bet. Thank you.
The caller is wrong about public opinion. And, you know, listeners can go to the website of the Kaiser Family Foundation and take a look at their polls, and what you'll see is there is not a majority for single payer, although there is quite substantial support in their polls, but it's sort of around an equal number of Americans who are for it or against it, and it varies with how you ask it, but there certainly is not a strong, consistent majority in favor of single payer in public opinion polls. It is very hard to predict the future. I think I can predict not many things right about the future. What I can predict is that in 2010, there's not going to be a majority in Congress for single payer. And again, I'm sympathetic to it personally, but if I just think about the politics, it's just not going to be there. And again, being right in health reform doesn't help you all that much politically. If it was just a matter of having the right health reform plan, well, we would have enacted national health insurance a long, long time ago. And so you have to work in this political system that is irrational and difficult, and you have to work from a healthcare system that is quite irrational and very difficult to change, and you've got to thread the needle. And I do agree with the caller that threading that needle is difficult, and as a result, we're likely to get health reform that, even if it's a big step forward, is going to fall short of where we would want it to be. But that doesn't mean that an alternative like single payer is going to be in the cards anytime soon.
Let me just make a comment for our listeners. If those of you who would like to go to the Kaiser Family Foundation, you can go to our website. We have a link to a side-by-side comparison of current health care proposals that is on the Kaiser Family Foundation. You can look at some of the polls there. There's also a link to the American College of Physicians website, which has a number of comments about some of the health care advocacy going on by that group of individuals. And I will add, or shortly after the program today, the National Public Radio site, which has a number of good reports, particularly about looking at how we compare our, and how we do our health care here compared to Germany, Germany, France, Holland, Switzerland are the ones that come to my mind. It's a, it makes good reading, and they're very short, very succinct bits of information there. All right, so let's assume that you're right. We can't predict the future, and we're probably, you're right in that we're not going to have a single payer. How do we do the best we can with what we're going to probably end up with? What can we be doing? What should we be doing? What's happening out there right now? And then with the healthcare, and what should we be trying to do? What should we be looking for?
Well, I think there are a couple key factors to keep in mind. First of all, the second best alternative we've got to single payer is having this public option, this Medicare-like program for people under 65 that creates an opportunity for Americans to enroll in a plan that's non-for-profit and in a plan that won't be engaging in some of the behaviors that the insurance industry has over the years. So one thing to watch is the fate of the public plan. And what you see right now is a division in the House. The Democrats are pushing forward a fairly robust version of a Medicare-like public plan. But in the Senate, there's a deep disagreement among Democrats on the different committees, and in particular, Senate Finance is looking at an ever-evolving list of really weakened public plan versions that I frankly don't think would amount to all that much. So one issue is the public plan. The second issue is really what kind of regulations are we going to have for private insurance? The previous caller mentioned that actually many countries in Europe do not have single-payer. Many of them have multi-payer systems. But their insurance companies look almost nothing like ours. They're non-for-profit, and they're very tightly regulated. They have to take all comers. They can't charge people on the basis of medical risk. There's lots of public accountability. So we really need to think carefully and keep an eye on what kind of regulation is Congress considering. And finally, we need to watch for what kind of subsidies are going to be enacted. Something we've not talked about is that both the House and the Senate are contemplating an individual requirement that Americans would have to obtain insurance unless it was deemed unaffordable for them, and what President Obama has called a hardship exemption. And if we are going to have that kind of individual mandate, it is extraordinarily important that there be adequate subsidies in this program, because if there are not adequate subsidies and if we do not control costs over time, that individual mandate is going to end up being punitive and unworkable.
And what are the what's the likelihood? Again, I'm going to ask you to predict the future, which we got to remember nobody's been very good at in the history of civilization. But what's the likelihood that these kinds of changes will come to fruition?
Well, my crystal ball is always foggy, and when I predict these health reform things, it's impenetrable. I can't see anything, but I'll give it a go. I think the public plan, what you're going to see is the House is going to have a decent version of a public plan, and the Senate is not. It's going to have a very weak version, and so it's going to come down to conference committee, and I have no idea what's going to come out of conference committee, and it really depends on, in large part, on whether President Obama intervenes on behalf of a public plan at that point in the debate. On the issue of regulation and how well are we going to regulate private insurers, I think that's an open question. I think the insurance industry in the United States is very difficult to regulate, and while they have agreed and conceded to some forms of regulation in this bill, I'm not persuaded that we're going to be able to implement those regulations in a foolproof way, which is why I think it's important, so important, to have a public plan option. And by the way, about 76% of Americans and some of the polling support the idea of a public plan option. And finally, on the subsidies, this concerns me a lot because we've put this artificial price tag on how much reform can cost, $1 trillion, in the Senate Finance Committee. And one of the ways you get under that price tag is by reducing subsidies. So I'm very worried at the end of the day that we're going to end up with an expansion of insurance coverage, but an expansion that falls short of what we could do if we were willing to spend a little bit more money.
I like to always look at incentives. It seems to me that one of the things we've learned from psychology, the social sciences, is that humans, as a rule, not always, but most of the time, they're going to do what they are incentivized, I guess is the correct word, to do. And we've kind of, I think Paul Hochfeld had mentioned that aspect of things in when he was the first caller earlier today. Is that correct in your mind? And so in what we're trying, and if so, is it reasonable to expect those who are doing some of this, making the plans for our country's healthcare changes, to consider how they can correctly incentivize the behaviors of both the payers, the insurance companies? I like to think of it as a triumvirate, the payers, the physicians, and the public. We keep leaving the public out of it, but they drive healthcare costs and some of their behaviors and how they do things, as do physicians and then the payers. What can we do all that? Can we incentivize them correctly if that's the right thing to try to do?
Well, I would never bet on Washington incentivizing correctly. And in all fairness, it's really difficult to get the incentives right in healthcare. But, you know, people like to talk about changing incentives. But let me give you one example that suggests how controversial it is to do. And so let's talk about the public and patients. And what one of the diagnoses of why healthcare costs are so high in the United States, according to some health economists, is people have employer-sponsored insurance that is tax-exempt. And as a result of it being tax-exempt, they have an incentive to get more and more generous coverage. It's worth more to them even than a dollar of payroll, a dollar of income, because it's not taxed. And so you wind up with what some people in Washington like to call these Cadillac health plans that are extraordinarily generous and supposedly encourage people to overuse the system, and that drives up costs. Now, the problem with that is now they want to talk about changing it. Well, how are they going to change that incentive? Well, the way they're talking about changing that incentive, at least on the Senate Finance Committee, is for the first time to tax some people's health insurance benefits. And that is immensely controversial. It is going to be profoundly unpopular with Americans who, when they hear the word health reform, what comes to their mind is not a tax on their health benefits. So changing incentives in the abstract is terrific. When you actually try and write the policies to do it, you run into a lot of trouble. And one of the other things to keep your eye on as this debate unfolds this summer is what Congress decides to do about taxing health insurance benefits from work.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about where things are going. What's the timeline for what's going to be happening in the near future about the health care debate?
Well, one of the most important factors in the timeline is the Obama administration and congressional leadership believes their best shot to pass healthcare reform is this year. So they're in a hurry. You know, the Rolling Stones wrote a song or sang a song a long time ago called Time is on Your Side. Health reformers believe that time is not on their side. So they want to get it done before President Obama's popularity dissipates, before concerns over the budget deficit overwhelm any political window to adopt meaningful reform. So they really are moving as fast as possible. The goal that they've set out is to pass legislation in both the House and the Senate by August 1. That date is significant because Congress is set to go on vacation. And so they want to go on vacation in August. They want to have this passed by then. They would then come back in the fall, and it would go to conference committee where the House and Senate would have to reconcile those two different pieces of legislation, and President Obama would like it to be on his desk by October 15th. So that's the timeline. It's an ambitious one, and I don't know that they're quite going to keep it, but that's the goal.
And I would expect then a lot of politicking will go on between the August well, I don't know if it would happen before the August break or and while the Congress is in vacation and before it comes back and then goes before the combination. When is it the easiest or the most important to be putting pressure on individuals?
Well, you know, it's important regardless of okay. whether you support single payer or another plan. Now is a great time to try and put pressure on your representatives and your senators. But there's certainly if, and this is a big if, but if the House and the Senate do pass comprehensive legislation by the end of the summer, there will be immense pressure on that conference committee because I believe they're going to be in several key respects fundamentally divergent bills. And so there are going to be intense efforts to influence that process, and you can include in that the Obama administration, which is going to have a big stake in the final outcome.
We really have only 2 or 3 minutes left, Dr. Oberlander, and I'd always like to also end up with some general thoughts that you might have about this this whole debate about whether or not we are, should be changing our healthcare system and what we should be doing about considering those changes. Do you have any words of wisdom, so to speak?
Not sure they're going to be words of wisdom, but I'll give them anyway. our healthcare system is in dire need of reform. We've waited so long to fix this, and the Institute of Medicine estimates that about 20,000 Americans die a year from not having health insurance, but it's not just about the uninsured. There are many Americans with private insurance in this country who are insecure in their coverage, who pay too much for it, and who aren't able to access medical care when they need it. So all Americans have a stake in health reform. And while I think reform is likely to fall short of what I would consider to be an ideal, what many Americans would consider to be an ideal, I'm still hopeful. I think we have a chance to make real significant progress this year in expanding insurance coverage and creating a more rational system. So this is a terribly important moment historically in health reform. And at the end of the day, I would say, let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Okay. Thanks very much. I appreciate your taking the time. I want to apologize to those callers who called in. We have not had time to get to them today. And my personal thanks to John Oberlander, Associate Professor of Social Medicine, Health Policy and Management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Have a good day, and thanks very much for your insights.
You take good care. It was great talking to you.
All right. Thank you. Next week, we're going to be back talking about another issue of some importance to all of us, and that's teen pregnancies. We'll be talking specifically about preventing teen pregnancies, what's been happening on that front, are we being successful, what works, and what doesn't work. And we'll be discussing that with Sarah Brown. Sarah is the Chief Executive Officer of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unintended Pregnancy. So please feel free to tune into Your Health and learn more Monday, July 6th at 2 p.m., remember that we'll repeat the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.